Thank you. So yes, I'm going to talk about Vanish, a system that we designed to increase data privacy by creating data that self-destructs. This is joint work with Yoshi Kono, Amit Levy, and Hank Levy from the University of Washington. So first, a brief outline of my talk. My talk has three parts. First, I will introduce the concept of self-destructing data. Then I will talk about Vanish, a system that provides self-destructing data. And finally, I will talk about some evaluation results and applications we built on top of Vanish. So let's begin with a motivating problem. And that problem is that data has started to live forever. Let's take the very simple example of email. Let's suppose that Anne wants to send a sensitive email to Carla, and that she trusts Carla that she won't be saving a copy of her sensitive email. However, on the way to Carla, Anne's sensitive email is going to go through many individual services and third parties, and each of these third parties and services may save copies and archive them of the sensitive email. For example, Anne's ISP might save copies of her email, Anne's Hotmail account might save copies as well, and so can Carla's corporate account. And if Carla's email is actually being forwarded to Gmail, Gmail may also save copies of Anne's email. So the question is, how can Anne delete her sensitive email? You know, she can try to delete her local copy of the email, and she can ask Carla to do so as well. However, she doesn't even know where all these copies are, right, in the cloud. And even for the places that she does know about, Anne doesn't really control the data storage at these various services. And in fact, it's well known that services may retain data for a very long time, even after the user tries to delete that data. And there is a huge problem that's arising here, because archived copies can resurface years later. For example, let's suppose we're now sometime later, a year or a month later, and some of the copies are already gone, but others still exist. So an attacker can come in with a subpoena or hack into the web service and obtain a copy of Anne's sensitive email. This is exactly what we call a retroactive attack on archived data, and this is a very important attack, and you're going to hear about it through the end of the talk, because this is exactly what Vanish and self-destructing data are designed to protect against. And because this attack is so important, let me detail the timeline of this attack. So the user uploads some data to some web service, copies get archived by various intermediaries, then the user tries to delete the data, but he's ineffective in doing so. And you know, months or years after, the retroactive attack begins. For example, an attacker comes with a subpoena. Okay, so given this retroactive attack, you may think that traditional encryption schemes, for example PGP, might be enough to protect against those attacks. However, in today's world, there are many ways in which an attacker can get their hands on decrypted versions of PGP encrypted data. For example, an attacker can get subpoenas for both the web service and Carla, right, the user, and thus obtain a decrypted copy of the email. And this is not just some made-up threat. There have been cases recently of judges that have ordered defendants to decrypt their PGP encrypted data. And in fact, recently, there is a new law in UK that demands that users release their keys to the UK police. As an alternative, the users might want to try a centralized service. So, you know, one of those that insert themselves into the process somehow and promise to help the user delete their data on time. Of course, there is a huge trust issue here at stake because, you know, there is no way for the user to actually know that there is no backdoor agreement between the centralized service and the attacker. You know, users may be especially wary at trusting such centralized solutions, especially after what happened not too long ago with Hushmail, an encrypted email company that spilled decrypted emails of their customers to the federal government. Okay, so we've looked at this simple example, and we've really identified two key challenges that are now facing privacy. The first, data has started to live forever. And it's happening everywhere. You know, on the web, we've talked about the simple example of email, but there are many others. You know, Facebook photos, Google Docs, blogs, you name it, they live forever. In the home, the same is happening because disks are so cheap and so large that there is really no need to ever delete any data. And finally, your pockets are filled with historical information. For example, your phone can store easily all of the messages that you've ever sent or received. The second problem is that retroactive disclosures of both data and user keys have become really commonplace recently. And there are many reasons why retroactive disclosures have occurred in the recent past. For example, hackers have hacked into users' accounts, various misconfigurations or technical glitches in web services have led to disclosures. Legal actions are being used more and more against emails. You know, laptops are getting seized at borders, and so on. So given these two problems, we ask the following question. Is there a way in which we can empower users with control over the lifetime of their data? And the answer that we came up with is this new definition of self-destructing data. And the idea in self-destructing data is the following. Instead of relying on the user to delete his data, which, as we've seen, can be ineffective, let's make the data just self-destruct. That is, the data, all the copies of the data will just time out at a point in time. Okay, so let's go back to our simple example and let's think how the self-destructing data model applies to that example. So Anne, instead of sending her sensitive email to Carla directly, what she will do is she will encapsulate that sensitive email into a self-destructing data object, specifying a timeout for it. She will then send that self-destructing data object over to Carla, and hence all of the copies stored in the cloud will be copies of the self-destructing data object. Now, the properties of the self-destructing data object are the following. Until the timeout, users can read the original message that's encapsulated in the self-destructing data object. After the timeout, however, all of the copies become permanently unreadable, even for attackers who can obtain an archived copy of the self-destructing data object and the user's keys from before the timeout. And moreover, all copies become permanently unreadable without requiring any explicit action of deletion on the part of the user or the services that store data, and without having to trust any centralized services. So these are the goals that we defined for self-destructing data. And you know, you might have heard about similarly named concepts, for example, the ephemerizer. But really, our list of goals is what is unique about our new definition of self-destructing data. And specifically, the last goal is differentiate us from previous work. OK. This leads me to the second part of my talk, which is Vanish, which is presenting Vanish, a self-destructing data system. So looking at traditional solutions, we've discovered that they are not sufficient to support the self-destructing data goals that we defined earlier. And we've already kind of hinted why PGP and centralized data management services don't really work. And it turns out that other well-known security solutions don't work either. So really, we wanted to try something completely new. And what we came up with was this idea of leveraging the services of huge-scale peer-to-peer systems in order to provide self-destructing data. So for those of you who don't know, let me give you a very brief background in peer-to-peer systems. A peer-to-peer system is a system composed of individually owned machines, for example, my machine, your machine, and so on, that volunteer resources to the network, to their peers, without having to any intermediary managed services in between. Now, peer-to-peer systems have a set of really important properties that are used by Vanish to achieve self-destructing data goals. And I'm going to go through the list here, and we're going to return to these properties later when we look at the security of our system. So the properties of the peer-to-peer system are the following. You know, these systems are huge scale. They span millions of nodes. They're also geographically distributed across hundreds of countries. They're completely decentralized. That is, they have no single point of trust. And finally, they are in constant evolution. That is, nodes come and go all the time, and hence the structure of the system changes over time. Okay. One particular type of peer-to-peer system is a distributed hash table, and this is actually what we use in Vanish. So the distributed hash table is just a system that's built on top of a peer-to-peer network that provides a hash table interface, you know, get, put, index value pairs. Now, DHTs, there are many DHTs out there, and they are mostly part of peer-to-peer file sharing applications, you know, legal or illegal file sharing. For example, Views, Mainline, CAD, they're all peer-to-peer file sharing applications that have DHTs embedded in them, and they're all huge. For example, Views has about 1.5 million nodes simultaneously connected to the network that are scattered across about 200 countries. So the idea in Vanish is to leverage these types of peer-to-peer systems, DHTs, in order to provide self-destructing data. So how does Vanish work? How do we achieve the self-destructing data goals? So let's go back to the simple example that we had before, and let's see how it would work with Vanish. So Anne, when she wants to send her sensitive email to Carla, what she will do is she will ask Vanish to encapsulate her data and specify a timeout for that data. Vanish will then pick two random keys, the data key K and the location key L. Vanish will then use the data key to encrypt the data and to generate a ciphertext. It will then take K and split it into many different pieces, N pieces, with a property that only M out of those N pieces are going to be needed in order to reconstruct the key K. And we use threshold secret sharing for this task. Okay. So with these key pieces, what Vanish will do is it will take the location key and provide it as a seed in a pseudo-random generator that will generate indexes in the DHT, at which Vanish will then push the key pieces and store them there. So essentially what happens is that Vanish hides the key pieces at random locations in this giant scale DHT. Okay. Then Vanish will just destroy all of the key pieces and key locally, and it will return what we call a Vanish data object or a video that is the combination between the ciphertext and the location key. This video is exactly what gets sent in the email over to Carla. When Carla receives the video, what she will do is she will ask Vanish to decapsulate it for her. Vanish will take the location key, will generate the same indexes in the DHT, and will retrieve the key pieces. It will then combine those key pieces back and reconstruct the data key K, will decrypt the data using the data key, and will return the data. Okay, so far we've assumed that the DHT, that all the key pieces are still available at the DHT at the time of decapsulation. However, it might be the case that some of the key pieces might have already been lost. For example, if the node storing them have left the system or have crashed. In that case, the fact that we are using threshold secret sharing, you know, we require only M out of the N key pieces in order to reconstruct K, means that we are shielded from accidental losses of the key pieces that can happen in the DHT. Okay, before the time. Okay, so we now understand how encapsulation and decapsulation work for Vanish. However, a really important property of Vanish, function of Vanish, is data timeout, right? Data destructions. How does that work in Vanish? Well, we've already said that the DHT may lose key pieces, right? And there are actually two reasons for this. One is natural churn, the fact that nodes crash or leave the system, and the second one is a built-in timeout that is present in most DHTs, and by which DHT nodes purge their data periodically to protect themselves against various DOS attacks. So what will happen in our system is that over time we'll keep losing key pieces up until a moment when we won't have enough key pieces to reconstruct the data key K. From that moment, we won't be able to reconstruct the data key K, we won't be able to ever decrypt the data again. So we've really, essentially, the key has vanished, and that's how the data, all the copies, encrypted copies, will become permanently unreadable. Okay. So now that we understand how Vanish works, let me go to the last part of my talk, which is evaluation and applications. Okay, so we ran extensive experiments to understand and improve four properties in our system. Data availability before the timeout, data unavailability after the timeout, performance, and security. Now, the paper contains graphs and results for each of these. However, for the purposes of this talk, I'm just going to talk about the security analysis. Okay. However, I do want to point out the highest level result that we achieved from this overall evaluation that we performed. And that's the fact that secret sharing parameters, N and M, are really key parameters in our system, and they affect all of these four properties: availability, timeout, performance, and security. And we've actually discovered that there is an interesting trade-off that has to be made always when you configure these parameters. But I invite you to read about that in the paper, and I will go next to the security evaluation. So a big part of our security evaluation consisted of defining the threat model. And we've said before that Vanish is really designed to protect only against retroactive attacks against old archived copies of data. You know, the exact definition of the threat model for retroactive attacks is pretty involved. However, intuitively, what it means is that attackers don't know their target until sometime after the timeout. So, for example, they don't know which user they want to attack, and they don't know which video they want to attack. Okay, however, it may be possible that the attackers may do any type of pre-computation, non-targeted pre-computation, during any point in time. However, that pre-computation is not targeted against any particular user or video. Finally, we assume a fundamental assumption that is actually included in this is that communicating parties trust each other. So, for example, Anne trusts Carla, won't be keeping a copy of the plain text. Okay, so with this threat model in mind, we looked at a bunch of retroactive attacks. There are more in the papers, I just listed several here. For example, we looked at what happens if Gmail decapsulates all of the videos and stores them, what happens if the ISP sniffs traffic, what happens in the case of various DHT attacks. However, for the purposes of this talk, I'm just going to focus on only two of them. The first one that I want to talk about is the following. The attacker's goal is to obtain the data via some legal means, for example, subpoenas. And we've already seen that this is what breaks previous PGP or centralized services solutions. In our case, the key defense is the inherent properties of the peer-to-peer system. The fact that the system is in constant evolution means that the node storing that used to store the keys at some point in time will have been gone from the system, right? So it's going to be extremely hard for the attacker to actually find them. And even if they find them, the fact that the DHT is geographically distributed and completely decentralized means that it's going to be extremely hard for them to come up with subpoenas, across many different international boundaries. Okay. The second attack that I want to talk about is one in which the attacker's goal is to capture any key pieces, as many key pieces as possible, from the DHT during a pre-timeout phase. A way in which the attacker can do that is by joining the DHT with many nodes and, capture whatever comes its way. So, for example, one way in which the attacker can get their hands on key pieces is via direct puts. If Vanish, for example, picks the random location, the index of the attacker node as the random location to store a key piece. There are other ways, indirect ways, in which the attacker can get key pieces, such as replication. Now, the question is that given the scale of the huge scale of these DHT systems, the question is how many nodes does the attacker need in order to be effective for some definition of effectiveness? And we ran some experiments for specific types of attacks, and we arrived at the conclusion, the current estimate is that the attacker must join with about 8% of the DHT size in order to capture about 25% of the videos. So that's our current result. However, of course, these systems are extremely difficult and right, complex, so there might be other attacks as well as defenses. Okay, so this leads me to the last point that I want to make, which is about Vanish applications. And Vanish is really general, and self-destructing data is general as well, and they support many applications. We've actually recently released Vanish, and we've included in our release a Firefox plugin for Vanish. And the community has actually, we're excited that the community has actually released very recently a Thunderbird plugin for Vanish as well. But there are other applications. For the purposes of this talk, I'll just introduce the Firefox plugin only. Okay, so the idea in the Firefox plugin is that the user is able to encapsulate any text that they type into any text area almost into self-destructing objects. That is, setting is in essence, setting a timeout on their text on the web. For example, the user can type into Gmail's compose text area some text, and then what they will do is they will select that text, right-click and select Vanish Encapsulate. What will happen is that Vanish will do whatever its magic, and then it will replace that your text with a Vanish object, video. Okay, now the cool thing about the Firefox plugin is that it can work anywhere. It's very, very seamless. So for example, you can put videos over Gmail, you can send them over Hotmail, you can put videos in a Google document, for example, if you want to protect some very sensitive portions of your document. You know, you can communicate with your friends over Facebook messages using videos, and so on. Lots and lots of uses. So this is, we believe, a very powerful effect, because it proves that Vanish can empower users with seamless control over the lifetime of their data on the web, at least the text data. Okay, so this leads me to conclusions, and we've talked about two formidable challenges that are now facing privacy. One is the fact that data is leaving, has started to leave forever, and the second one is the fact that disclosures of both data and keys have become commonplace. We have proposed a new definition of self-destructing data that empowers users with control over the lifetime of their data. And we've talked about Vanish, a system that provides self-destructing data by combining global scale DHTs with the secret sharing technique in order to achieve the goals of self-destructing data. We also talked about a Firefox plugin that allows users to set timeouts on any data that they, text data that they upload to the web. Now, the last thing that I would like to point out is that Vanish is different from Vanish plus Views. And you know, if you were to redesign a DHT, you could implement a bunch of improvements on top of today's DHTs. There are further extensions that we talk about in the paper, and I would invite you to read that paper. So with that, I put the URL to our release, and I will now take questions.
Let's thank the speaker. We have time for some questions.
The NNM, those parameters, does the software choose those, or does the user have to know what the NNM are?
You can configure it. However, we include some defaults, you know, and we've run actually extensive experiments to show, you know, to see what the availability curve is, what the unavailability curve is for the current views. And you know, also the security, as I mentioned, there is a trade-off between this that has to be met. However, the user, if the user is very concerned with security, they will increase, and we have some guidelines of how, you know, what needs to be increased, when, and so on. So they would need to increase the rights or to set the parameters in a certain way. If they want security, if they care more about performance, for example, they would need to set them in a different way. But we do have a kind of a, something that we believe would work for most cases, at least.
So I saw on one of your slides you had a list of potential threats, and one of them was, I think, Gmail choosing to decrypt all, or decapsulate all videos.
Yes.
And I think the remedy you suggested was encrypting with PGP. Doesn't that leave you back at the original problem that PGP does not actually solve the problem you were trying to solve?
Okay, so here's what I meant. That's a very good question. However, so how it would work is the following way. You have the self-destructing data object that will self-destruct in any case. Now you want to protect it against, because the self-destructing data object doesn't prevent somebody in the middle, right, in the cloud, from decapsulating while it is still alive and saving the clear text, what we propose is encapsulating that self-destructing data object into wrapping it into PGP. What will happen is that later on, when the attack comes and requests the PGP key from the user can give it the can give the attacker the PGP key. However, the self-destructing data object will have disappeared. That's inside, right? Will have disappeared anyway.
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Sarah from Florida State University. I wanted to let you know I really enjoyed your talk. Data persistence is something that we're all going to have to, unfortunately, deal with more and more in the future, even a lot right now. I did want to ask you, though, at the very beginning of the talk, you mentioned that centralized storage is not an option. And I did want to ask you, have you ever heard of the Tahoe LFS, or Tahoe LAFS? It's a... I believe it's a cloud storage started by someone named Zuko Wilcox O'Hearn. Mm-hmm. And it's essentially data is encrypted in a storage, but the user keeps the key.
Okay. I haven't heard of it.
If the storage is ever subpoenaed, they can, mm-hmm. all they can hand over is the crypto. They can never hand over the plain text because they don't have the key. But it is more work on the user to, of course, delete their keys. If they
okay.
were to securely
So sure, that's a huge issue, and actually the ephemerizer paper, another paper that kind of is on the same topic, talks about it. The fact that it's so difficult to manage these keys. I must say that first of all, I haven't heard of this particular example, but okay. from what you tell me, it's going to be a huge burden on the user to delete those keys securely, right? Because you know of all the archives that happen. Right, the users back up their systems. So it's going to be a really difficult problem. And that's why actually the ephemerizer system, for those of you who are familiar with it, tries to handle that situation.
Thank you.
Hi, Aniket Kante, I'm from University of Waterloo. The system was really elegant and it was good to see your presentation. I have a question about the pre-computation attack which you mentioned. There, your L, which is a pseudo-random generator, that's available with your encrypted data. So somebody, if your organization, your emails are passing through your organization, and the system administrator can know that L, and just use that in pre-computation to compute all your indices and finding out data, right? So.
That is exactly the attack that I was talking about in the vid, I had this attack, sorry. About the Gmail decrypting your Gmail, the second one. It's kind of the same attack where some party in the middle decapsulates the video while it's still available and saves the clear text. Is this what you're talking about? First, I want to make sure that
I was thinking my attack is more like the huge scale attack, but
which one?
The second attack which you mentioned, the P2P property.
Yeah, the Gmail attack, right? No?
Yeah, or I thought I'm talking about the capture key pieces from DHT in pre-computation.
Oh, okay.
So if somebody captures key shares in pre-computation, then instead
yeah,
of just
sure.
being part of DHT,
yes.
they are like somebody mm-hmm. who gets to know your L, the pseudo-random generator.
Exactly. Actually, I do think that it falls better in the first example, because what happens there is that the system in the middle knows your L because it knows your video. That's exactly the attack that I'm talking about there. It knows your L, therefore it can go to the same indexes and retrieve the keys while they are still available. And that's exactly the attack, and we have this, it can be protected against using things like PGP standard, encryption like PGP.
Okay, we have time for one quick question.
Hi, do you anonymize the endpoints in the communication? And if not, what keeps the attacker from subpoenaing the system of the recipient in order to recover the cached reassembled key?
the system of the recipient, for example, in this example, Carla. Or,
right. If I send a message to Carla, then can't the attacker just subpoena to receive Carla's computer?
Sure. So, again, we are talking about retroactive attacks. That is, attacks that occur at a later time, months or years after the object has self-destructed, the email has self-destructed. Therefore, you will have already lost your keys. Therefore, the subpoena will not work against the destinatory or the origin.
But Carla had to do an M of N reassembly on the local machine.
Yes.
Which means that she has the key pieces cached somewhere. So you could still achieve these keys, right?
A month or a year later. So the assumption in a retroactive attack is the following. You're not going to... So at the time when the users communicate... So let me give you a very simple example. You send out an email, and you talk about some health issue, not you, whatever. Somebody talks about some health issues, right? Then at some point in time, much later on, a subpoena comes in from an insurance company and wants your email. So that's the model. After some time later, you're not being monitored at the point when the email is still alive. That's what I'm trying to say. And therefore, there is no, and also the users trust each other. So I've mentioned this assumption that the users have to trust each other. Therefore, Carla won't be saving a copy of her email, of Anne's email, that's protected in this way.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, let's thank the speaker again.